The following audio presentation is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Family Studies as part of our monthly seminar series in which we showcase national and international research related to the family. The seminars are designed to promote a forum for discussion and debate. They are open to the public and free of charge.
And as Ruth did, I too would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on the land on which we're meeting today, the Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'd like to pay my respects to their elders, both past and present. To those of you who are joining us on the webinar, I understand you are 200 strong and you are meeting on various nations, country around Australia. So thank you very much for joining in to today. I'd like to also acknowledge all of you and thank you for living the lives that you have, and also to acknowledge your ancestors and parents in particular for instilling in you the kind of values that really give true meaning to the words, my fellow Australians. And on that then, I'm very excited to be here today to talk with you about the first 1,000 days and thinking about some protective factors within families. I'm going to focus specifically on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families and think about how investing in this particular period of time can be a real catalyst for action that will stand people in good stead over the course of their lifetime. I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about how I actually came to think about and focus on the first 1,000 days. In 2014, I was also the chair of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Equity Council. It was a national body that was set up to oversee the development and implementation of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan. During that time, we started to think about links between policy drivers and decisions about at-risk populations in particular. And we also had a wonderful presentation by someone by the named Professor Joseph Sparling, who came to us and talked about the extraordinary opportunities that were happening by implementing something called the Abecedarian Project, and internationally, particularly for vulnerable children and developmentally delayed children. What this was doing was increasing their IQ percentiles at such a rate that it allowed low-functioning children to be able to participate in school because of the way they were able to modify their behaviour, but also overcome some of their developmental vulnerabilities enough to be able to participate in school programs. And that, we know, is a really important marker for future health and well-being. The other piece of work that I had done was working as the chair for a group with the unfortunate title of NATSIDAG, but it was the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Dementia Action Group. And a very long time ago, I got told by people who didn't know any different, really, that we shouldn't necessarily worry about dementia because we were all dying before we got dementia anyway. But some of the early interventions or the new public health space in dementia action was actually focusing during this first 1,000 days. And for us now to see then the impact of this period of time on adolescent growth and development as well as healthy, well aging was pretty spectacular. I also then, because of my work in sexual and reproductive health and particularly around early childhood, I was talking with Jan over here before. I am an old, on-the-ground, experienced child protection worker from my old social work days. But certainly, the first 1,000 days internationally is a specific nutrition intervention to stop growth stunting and to overcome anemia and growth faltering in developing countries. And whilst that is an important consideration for Australian populations, there is also a lot of work that could be done in social and behavioural and parenting strategies, so really addressing the holistic frame of health through early childhood interventions. We're also seeing an increase in young women being represented in prison populations across the country. There was a fantastic report that was done here by the Human Rights Commission on the overrepresentation now of women, who, and some of whom are parents in prison populations, and then what that meant for parental interruption and disruption of those early childhood years. And then we've also got this unfortunate circumstance at the moment where our men are quite invisible in policy, in programs, in interventions, in being considered partners in a programmatic sense. And that invisibility, I think, has had an extraordinarily detrimental effect on how we engage with and support families and men as parents, as opposed to men as bashers or those who perpetrate domestic violence or those who are stereotyped as pedophiles, I think is something that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women are taking a greater stand on. And this has been a really important consideration in this, how we've actually thought about and developed the first 1,000 days intervention. What we also know is that it is a real key to health and longevity. Childhood brain development can predict adult health and well-being across all different lifespans, and what we want to do is work with the genes that people have, but also with parents, teachers and peers to help really grow children's minds and brains. We also know that a lot of our kids are experiencing some adverse childhood events, particularly stress and trauma. I talked a little bit about absent parenting, but overcoming that, we can make some really strong impacts on neurodevelopment. And we can really focus some work on getting kids to pay attention and to overcome some of the learning deficits often associated with what we understand now to be post-traumatic stress disorders. We can also really give kids an educational advantage. Under-stimulated children in our communities are not getting read to, they are not getting socialised that will help enhance their health and well-being once they get into school. And so really focusing on that, I think, is a really important challenge for all of us, but something that can be easily overcome through a process of just reading with and engaging children. I'm going to spend some time talking a little bit about that soon. We also know that there are a number of challenges of doing this work. The first 1,000 days, as I understand it and how we've started to talk about it in an Australian context, is absolutely from conception through to age 2. All of the childhood policies in an Australian government context at the moment operate from birth to age 3. What we're doing, though, is missing out on some extraordinary developmental opportunities that occur during pregnancy. And we're also missing opportunities to do good work in that preconception phase. And the reason why I say that is because the best time to talk about pregnancy is when you're not, just saying. However, if we are finding young women or vulnerable people who become pregnant, what we also want to do is make sure that we've got some good measurable outcomes for the first 1,000 days across different sectors and regions. We do want to address the issues of vulnerability and preconception. We want to be able to focus on women's empowerment, about educational attainment. We do want to address issues of criminality through relationships and through family strengthening activities. A lot of my early work in particular found that the first time that women experienced domestic violence was during their pregnancies. And so being able to overcome that is a really important aspect of the work. We also know that vulnerable families have to interface with at least 7 or 8 different healthcare providers over the course of a 2-year period. And what we want to do is create a workforce that covers off from conception through to age 2. We're thinking about a case-managed style of approach. We're talking about home-based interventions, but really either nurse-led or health worker-led interventions seem to have the greatest traction in different regions around Australia. We also want to tackle some of the early stresses in children's lives around separation from parents, around poverty, and just around childhood stress. And I'm going to talk a little bit about maternal experiences of racism, for example, on interfacing with a whole range of providers that are supposed to be there to look after and promote people's health and well-being. That isn't necessarily happening at the moment. People are experiencing racism. Again, another really good report came out about that recently. We want to be able to provide upmarket early education, health services and schoolings and jobs. We want to be able to include parents in that. And we want to be able to ensure that institutional responses are appropriate. There are a whole range of functions that we're looking to establish partnerships with others, not only in Melbourne but around the country, to have a look at different kinds of opportunities to do really good interventions, particularly with vulnerable Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children during this time. The first one is transitional interventions, so looking between, for example, upon release from hospitals or child and maternal health services, who follows that young vulnerable mother back home? Upon release from prison, why aren't fathers and mothers getting parenting classes as part of their discharge plans? Another example is around coming out of, say, drug and alcohol rehabilitation services, then what kinds of opportunities to really engage with families and with your kids are there, particularly if they've had to be taken into kinship or other care arrangements? What are we doing to really transition kids and families back into a family unit? We also want to be able to create scientific evidence to use in strategies to support vulnerable families. Whilst there is good work being done, they are not yet universally applied. They're not available to everyone in Australia. There might be some cultural differentiations around different regions that need to be considered. But surely to goodness, we can find some good scientific evidence to use in strategies to bring into policy, to bring into programs, and really make sure that we are focusing on evidence-based strategies. And we want to be able to design, implement and evaluate preconception, early childhood and parental support interventions. I think a lot of this work is being done around the country by service providers who have not got the kinds of partnerships or capacity to be able to do good evaluations that end up in the peer-reviewed publications to inform other strategies going on. And I've been a very strong advocate in this space around partnerships with universities to make sure that that happens. And again, we really want good knowledge exchange opportunities, and we want to be able to create a banner of the first 1,000 days and have a suite of activities happen under that banner and see where we go to today. So that's how I came to understand the first 1,000 days. That's how I'm going to be working with it over the next couple of years. And in terms of where we're at, my apologies. I'm going to give you an overview of the presentation today. Hopefully I'm going to be able to talk a little bit about the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Strategy, its emphasis on early childhood, but what that does is a real trigger for us to be able to do some really good, exciting, innovative work and build on what's already happening around the country. I have to say that there are some wonderful, wonderful examples of the first 1,000 days work going on. It's not called that at the moment, but if it was going to be positioned somewhere in a lifespan intervention, then it would definitely come under the first 1,000 days umbrella. I'm going to focus a little bit on the outcomes of the scientific symposium that we had in April. Over 100 people came from 30 different organisations around Australia. We've got another couple planned, and I'll talk a little bit about them later on. I want to be able to talk about how we might optimise health inequity outcomes for parents and what kind of protective factors are there in families and what can we do to support and bring them to the fore. There are, of course, some core service requirements in the field. We need to be able to decide what they are, and there's a very good process going on at the moment through the Northern Territory Aboriginal Health Plan and the Health Forum, who got consensus last week about what they are. There's also some real benefits across the country from service level integration, particularly across justice, education and health. That's not something that we're good at the moment. We can conceptualise it. We're pretty lousy, though, at implementing them, but there are some good examples. And then about being able to shape evidence, policy and resourcing environments. So that's what I'm going to focus on over the next little while. And for me, where this catalysing idea came from, what is it a catalyst for, was in January 2014, Prime Minister Abbott did set a target for bridging the gap in school attendance between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples within 5 years by employing truancy officers in communities. So there was this idea that if you could just go around, gather up all the kids and get them to school, that that would have a lasting impact across their lives and help them achieve educationally in a way which would allow them to engage with the market economy. Well, we all know that that's not quite right, because there are a range of kids who can't attend school full-time for behavioural or developmental reasons. And so what we need to do really is change the early childhood agenda from one of school preparation to one that addresses developmental delays early, so kids are better prepared for school when they finally get there. We need a push for more action, greater coordination and stronger investments to ensure equity targets are met, and we need all governments to continue these commitments and save the next generation from the challenges of inequity. And it's time to really revisit a few fundamentals of human development. At a time in a child's life when changes in service integration and family engagement can deliver on that promise of childhood equity. So that's what we are really focusing on at that time. In terms of overcoming fragmentation, the first change is to overcome the fragmentation of local health, education, welfare and justice, as well as other social services. Secondly, we need to ensure services are knitted together at a regional level, under the auspice of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leadership. And finally, we need high quality evidence bases to underpin programs that are grounded both in the neuroscience of early brain development and in the complex effects of social and community environments on children's development. So coordinating those interventions is really very important. And we need to make sure that those investments are properly engaging parents and vulnerable children with the interrelated issues such as maternal mental health, parental incarceration, racism and family stress, and also to engage with child protection and welfare systems if we have any chance really of being incredibly effective. So in terms of this new equity building framework, what we want to be able to do is build frameworks that promote multi-agency strategies to engage children to focus on that early period of child development. And possible template for that is the first 1,000 days. We believe that there are some extraordinary things going on around the globe. There is a lot of international evidence now. We were talking before, Moira and I, about the Wave Trust that's happening over in England. Long-term studies that are really showing the impact of what happens when you engage children and their families during that time. We also know that there is work that can be done around adolescence through healthy behaviour modification, around delaying pregnancy and parenting, getting parenting education. That used to happen in schools. I worked in family planning associations for a great number of years. That's all we did. That was our bread and butter. But that doesn't seem to have hit the national curriculum anywhere, and it doesn't seem to have really hit anywhere where there are kids who are not attending school. And so making sure that we really address these issues through adolescence, and making sure that women of reproductive age are able to access good contraception, that they get good preconception care, good nutrition, and that they actually have a good sense of themselves as empowered young women, as well as empowered young men who are really interested in making the decision, but understanding fully what fatherhood means for them. And I think that that's a really important conversation that we need to have. There's also some really good opportunities to work with neonates and infants and children, of course. And so these equity building frameworks, if we can work on those trigger points, will actually elicit some fantastic responses into the future. In terms of the first 1,000 days and it as an enabling environment, what we want to do is actually really focus on supporting the inherent strengths and resilience in communities. So we Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have to say we are sick to death of being described as a deficit, that our problems are too big, that our problems actually need outside external interventions. We have been here for 40,000 plus years. We are strong, we are capable, we are mobilising ourselves, and what we need to do really is have the space to be able to demonstrate some good leadership in that. What we can do though is really bring together some disparate programs at the moment, particularly around home nursing, child protection and fathering support, with evidence-based very early learning programs, for example. And out of that, I think there would be some really catalysing equity opportunities for our kids and addressing one of those really important and critical issues of our time. And certainly cultural aspects and the cultural protective behaviours are absolutely going to be at the forefront of the implementation of any programs over the next 10 years or so. The National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan has culture very firmly placed in its centre, and it is around having the right to live a healthy, safe and empowered life with a healthy, strong connection to culture and country. And as you can see around that, there are a number of priority areas that are specifically focused on early childhood interventions. In terms of then what are culturally protective factors, we still don't necessarily know, and this is one of those questions that I'm longing to ask people. I haven't quite designed the research program yet to do it. But what are the cultural determinants of health and well-being during the first 1,000 days of life? What are they? And I'm not quite sure I know, even though I've been working in this area for a long time. But certainly, we understand that some of our culturally protective factors are around maternal education, around positive fathers to influence behaviours of mothers to go and access health services during pregnancy, to be a good role model for their kids. We know that functional kinship systems are important, having a stimulating environment, cultural knowledge and child-rearing practices, including birth spacing, all of those things being brought into play. We know that community decision-making and effective governance is also a critical part of a culturally protective environment. We know access to language, and we know transitions from breastfeeding to solids without the intervention of Nestlé, for example, is a really important culturally protective factor. We also know that there are a range of strategies that we can employ to really make sure that those culturally protective factors remain within families. They are to engage people in narratives about who they are, what their stories are, what their life is like, and then really engaging with them in a very practice-based way, about all of us having partnerships together so that one person can come and tell their story once rather than having to tell their story across multiple different players, about exercising leadership and control through an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community lens, and then really bringing that to the fore. Having our elders engaged, looking at whole of person, whole of experience, so really having an ecological approach to health and well-being. Cultural safety, that we invest in cultural safety through our agencies and have two-way learning strategies. There is no point in doing work in this space if you can't have a grandmother and grandfather working alongside you for the benefit of those kids in that family. And so looking at ways of making sure that there is a power-sharing relationship in that intervention would be really important. And that's the way then that we respect the role of culture in the development and delivery of healthcare and other kinds of services. In terms of cultural and what it can influence, we know that culture influences decisions about why and when people seek healthcare, their acceptance of treatment, their likelihood of adherence, and the follow-up and likely success of prevention and health promotion strategies. And we know then that early childhood strategies need to restore and continue culture, providing both the reason for change and the pathway for securing it. And you cannot do that without those cultural mediators within communities and having some kind of decision-making governance arrangement that is absolutely community-led. We have a range of principles that we're trying to operationalise all this work through, and particularly again through the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan. They are around health equality and human rights, community control and engagement, about partnerships based on respect and accountability. All of us have to be accountable for the monies that we receive and the work that we do and the way that we engage with and support families. It's actually too important now for us to get this wrong. If we make this level of investment during this period of time, then we absolutely will achieve equity in a generation. But if we bugger it up, then I doubt very much whether people are going to give us the chance to do it again right in the next little while. In terms of some of the health enablers, what we need is cultural respect and non-discriminatory healthcare systems. And so people have really focused on this notion of being free from racism. We need effective and clinically appropriate care. We need evidence-based practice. Again, the partnerships with universities and other research institutes is so important. Mental health and social emotional well-being, and really integrating that as a concept through all of our different practices, and really focusing on building our community and human capability, and that notion of having a workforce that is meaningfully engaged with vulnerable families in particular. And then we've started to really see this shift happen. So instead of child and maternal health, which is a biologically constructed, makes our men invisible process of just engaging with mothers and their children, we've really started to see that our cultural practice and societal roles affect the roles that fathers and other male members play in the development of the child. And there is a strong push now to start really moving towards having children and family services. So really being able to move from a maternal focus to a family-based focus. It's really something that seems to be coming up more and more for people. And I just want to talk a little bit about the scientific symposium that we had in April. We're getting the report out fairly soon, but what we wanted to do was have the first kind of conversation about developing a clear evidence-based strategy to support all vulnerable parents and kids in Australia. And the reason that we had this scientific symposium was to get a good core knowledge base that combines insights from scientific research, program evaluation, and on-the-ground experience, and we certainly got that. The report should be finalised within the next 2 weeks, and we'll be able to have that up and available on our website. But certainly, a lot of the presentations that we had were just illuminating about what's really important and what's possible to be done. One of the first presenters who came and had a talk with us was Andrew Jacquemos, who is Victoria's Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People, who really focused on his talk around the, although there are a great majority of Aboriginal kids in Victoria that are in loving homes, who are raised well, who are well and healthy, that there are a minority of kids who are incredibly vulnerable. And as a result of that vulnerability, they are being removed at a very high rate. So he started in about 18 months ago to do some work on Task Force 1000, which was looking at the 1,000 kids who were in care at that time. Unfortunately, that number has escalated and now it's kind of like Task Force 1800. So a lot of our kids end up in care. A lot of the statistics on these kids reflect the extent of their vulnerability. They'll have higher rates of intrauterine exposure to cigarette smoke and drug abuse, poorer birth outcomes with lower birth weights. Throughout childhood, they'll participate less in early years of education and more likely to be suspended and expelled from a government school. They'll be exposed to higher rates of racial abuse and discrimination. They'll have higher or greater involvement with the youth justice system, higher rates of incarceration, higher rates in the experience of violence. And these kids really need our care and support. And I think that if we can do something for these kids in particular and support Andrew Jacquemos and his work as the Commissioner for Aboriginal Kids, that would be a tremendous outcome of the work of the first 1,000 days. In terms of the tables that he had a look at, and he's just done a big investigation, particularly around kids in out-of-home care, the parameters that he had a look at were the factors contributing to ongoing placement, levels and integrity of community input at the time that these children were removed, children's genogram and identification of intergenerational traumas through to educational plans, history of involvement of that family with the police, assessments of adequate support services and systems, identification of areas for improvement in that child's life. And I think that what's happening now is the development of a whole range of regional plans are being put into place now that the task force has completed its audit and it's coming to a conclusion. There is a real push on to do implementation in this space. The findings have been presented to multiple agencies, including care, child protection, and criminal justice. And the reasons for their placement are multifactorial, and include issues around the support and provision of support services for family and kin, around finding suitable accommodation, around addressing parental substance abuse and incarceration, and around really focusing on the development of Aboriginal-led decision-making and making sure that those things happen in a timely manner. And so being able to do that, I think, has been a really important... I don't know what that slide says. However, as a result of this, what we're seeing now, again, is a really big investment in making sure that we get child protection services right. And there are now 110 new child protection jobs happening in Victoria. We are looking for predominantly Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who have trained in that particular area. They can come from other parts of the country and work with families here in Victoria, but that, I think, will be a really interesting initiative to see how long kids are in care, how they're transitioning out of care back into family homes, and then what kinds of cultural plans and other kinds of supports are in place for those kids while they're not with their families. Another presentation happened at the conference from Central Australian Congress, who is using the Australian Early Development Index to measure five developmental domains in their kids. There are some really strong implications that they've picked up on through these developmental measures that they've now implemented into their work, which has been quite extraordinary. They've started to implement a joint thing. My daughter used to go to their childcare centre, but it's become a real Abecedarian-focused centre and one of the few, if not the only, Aboriginal Abecedarian early childhood centre in Australia. Don't quote me on that, but I believe that's to be the case. It's co-located next door to a primary healthcare service, which has got a long-term engagement with families in this particular space. But in terms of what they've been able to do, there are two programs in particular. What they've been able to do is get the dose response requirement in the Abecedarian project. So for kids throughout the course of a day, you're meant to read to them three times a day for 15-minute slots. And if you really do one-on-one engagement with kids during that time, then what you see is language and other kinds of developmental indicators rise incredibly well. What they're able to do through the Central Australian Congress is one dose a day, and they're able to do that consistently, and they measured it over an 8-week period. So we're talking once a day, 15 minutes a day, reading to that child, and the language improvement is on average 7 months. So 15 minutes a day over an 8-week period will give you a 7-month increase in language development. Unbelievable. The other thing that they're doing is nurse-led family partnership programs. They are working with families in a case management approach. They are going back out to homes. They have been the major support for these young mums and their families over the course of that child's life. And they are starting to see incredible cognitive, social, and physical development occur during that time. It has commenced in 2009. It's an outreach program that's having spectacular results. And the evidence now is coming through very strongly about that being a really important part of achieving, and this region is on track to achieve childhood equity by 2031, that's a really important platform for that piece of work. Another program that we saw was called the Baby One program from Appanipama Cape York Health Council. I used to work up there, and this is one of the most extraordinary programs that we've seen. It's a highly incentivised health-seeking behaviour, Aboriginal health worker-led program of activity where over the course from the pregnancy through to birth and beyond, parents and their children are being seen over 15 times. It's an intensive program. They're given baby baskets, not unlike the cardboard boxes that every woman in Finland is offered. And what's happening then is that they're really engaging during that first 1,000 days, and people are able to reduce the vulnerability because they've had one person manage their care all the way through that period of time. It helps vulnerable mothers access health specialists and other kinds of services when they need it. That brings fathers into the play. It's these women, and they're starting to get some men now to be part of the program, but it really is enabling empowerment and also capacity building of parents as parents and as parents who are caring for their kids. And it's been a real circuit breaker in a whole range of the vulnerability that has occurred. But again, I mean, what we're starting to see here are some really strong key features about important aspects of the program around community control and around having population-based approaches and not only addressing some of the physical health as it presents in through the clinics, but really addressing some of the social, emotional, spiritual, environmental, and cultural well-being, and having that one-on-one relationship with someone who becomes like a bigger sister or a sub, you know, or an auntie or something like that, and engaging in that space is really, really very powerful. Then we had a look at first 1,000 days across the lifespan. And certainly during adolescence, what we recognised we needed to do was to consolidate those gains made in child health and modify some future health-related behaviours and influence socioeconomic development of the individual and really start to focus on them as young leaders. Some of the work that's happening up in the Territory at the moment, we're starting to talk to 14-year-old girls around getting IUDs. Those were conversations that health practitioners were terrified to have in the past, having long-term contraception made available to that age group of teenagers. But in terms of being able to be empowered around what your fertility looks like, even if you've got no control over what your sexuality and how that's being expressed or not, is a very, very important component of this full raft of first 1,000 days activities. And then we also heard from the Koori's Growing Old Well project. I do a lot more work in this in aged care. However, it's just to really highlight the fact that there are a whole range of people who've got dementia that have been involved with a program called the Koori Growing Old Well Study. It focuses on urban and regional Koori communities. It's a cognitive assessment tool that's being able to be delivered from Kimberley's down here through to Victoria and up in the north coast of New South Wales. And there are really important factors that occur during those first 1,000 days that could have an extraordinary impact on midlife factors for dementia, including mental health issues, anxiety and depression, as well as all those comorbidities around cardiovascular disease and the like. So we heard from this symposium that there was a range of opportunities both within regions but across the lifespan. There was a whole range of vulnerabilities that could be addressed by focusing on this work, and some of the key research ideas I think were pretty exciting. It was around looking at piloting first 1,000 days, looking at the impact of violence on early childhood, good nutrition, how social determinants translate into later stage disease, you know, how do you actually do family mentoring, what do you need to do to mobilise community to raise a child, what's the workforce requirements that we need to promote healing, what kind of interventions increase antenatal engagement, and what are some of the developmental pathways, particularly linkage pathways through different departments. There's also then some ideas about how to be the best parents we can be and what is good parenting and what does good parenting look like in a cultural context. Not sure we know that terribly well yet. And how do we establish a network of early childhood research programs? I also want to just talk very, this is the last kind of part of this discussion, but just what work is going on around the regions at the moment. Like I said, I was up in the Northern Territory last week with the Aboriginal Health Planning Forum there, and we do need some additional work to go on, particularly around core services. They're doing some fantastic work on this at the moment. But we know that we do need a public health approach to preconception. We need counselling around longer-term contraception. We need access to safe terminations of pregnancy. We need more sexual reproductive health education, particularly focusing on what a quality relationship looks like and empowerment and control over fertility options. That's a no-brainer. That is an absolute given, and it has been a given for the last 20 or 30 years. In terms of what works across the region, There are some good things that are starting to come through that look like they are key platforms of activity. The first is a case management approach by a stable workforce. The second is incentivised health-seeking behaviour. Third is comprehensive services through primary healthcare agencies. Fourthly, parental support. Fifth is taking an ecological approach. Next is about improving food security, education and health literacy, while addressing access to alcohol and other drugs, including tobacco. And then seven is around partners of services, not clients of services, and integration of cultural knowledge and child rearing practices into how we actually conceive of, design, and then implement our core services. And so those seem to be the really important aspects of the work that are coming through very strong. In addition, brief empathetic interventions by healthcare providers and others can have a major impact on how people conceive of themselves, particularly in relationship with healthcare and other providers. We do need some more rigorous research. If you can't access nutritious food, and this is something that came through from one of the workers at Barunga, failure to thrive isn't failure to thrive, it's failure to feed. And if we don't get access to good quality foods, then we do need nutritional supplements. And there's a whole range of ways or discussions to be had about that. But a deepening understanding about cultural determinants of health is really needed. And there is another workshop that's going to be happening, particularly on the issue of childhood anemia and growth faltering, and joining up activities across Northern Territory, Queensland and Western Australia. And there were some really good outcomes that started to come through from that. Of course, there are a range of challenges, but I think people really identified some of the approaches that they want to take, some of the principles. This workshop's being run from the Commonwealth, and it's got the auspice of the Prime Minister and Cabinet. It will happen in November. And in terms of what the groups were looking for, they really wanted a concrete plan of action about where to go to. And I think that that's what a lot of us are looking for in this space. What can we actually physically do to make a difference? And in terms of growth faltering and anemia, people wanted to have training programs. They wanted to know what made a program successful. They wanted to know about some good research questions that could be asked. And they wanted to know about how they could secure food security in different communities across the top end, and what are the next 5 years worth of innovative opportunities that are going to come if people were able to do a horizon scan. In terms of future areas of work that we've got on our radar, the next First 1000 Days Symposium is really focusing on community governance and on community-based interventions. And we're looking to hold that on the 25th of August here at Graduate House in Melbourne. We want to follow that with a researchers meeting. So again, all of those different regions, as I said, there is some really fantastic work going on. But what we want to do is identify what kind of data do we all need to collect in a way which can make it comparable across Australia. And so that's going to be one of the next big discussions that we're going to have. And then finally, on the 5th of November, we're having a policy and influences kind of symposium workshop to really look at how we maximise service coordination across all those different areas, but also how we bring evidence into the policy cycle quicker. We can't wait 3 years for this. That's a whole another generation of kids who have gone too far to really make the kind of impact that you can during that first 1,000 days. And so with that, my people, I'm going to finish off there and leave it open for questions if there are any. Thank you so much for your time. Like I said, this is just a bit of a quick skim on a whole body of work that's going on around the country and internationally at the moment. I really want to say thank you for joining with us on this discussion, and really hope that we might be able to partner together for a future where we are all free and all equal and all deserving of the lives that we end up with. Thank you.